It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pins the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Time for our Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch. And a quick note that we have a new phone number now, which is 650-LEGAL-MJ. That's 650-534-2565. And we got Dr. Mitch on the line. Welcome, Dr. Mitch. How you doing?
Crazy day. How are you?
I'm fantastic. And we're 15 days away from the election. How are you feeling about our prospects?
Very positive, but man, I can't wait till this is over.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's getting a little crazy out there. I'll be reporting in the next segment about how some medical marijuana proponents are joining up with Kevin Sabet and Project Sam to oppose Proposition 64. So things are getting pretty crazy out here in the West.
I'm looking forward to throwing a giant bag of legal pot at them.
Very good. All right, let's get to our questions. And also, I'm monitoring the chat room. If you got any questions in chat, we can get to those. But there's a whole bunch of studies that are out recently that we need to talk about. And the first one is actually the research by Keegan Hamilton out at Vice News, where he's picked up 121 pages of documents from the FDA that explain why they thought cannabis needs to remain in Schedule 1. And I understand, Dr. Mitch, it has to do with stoned monkeys.
Well, believe it or not, there were some data gathered on some four stoned monkeys who had quite a bit of smoke blown in their faces through a mask that may have deprived them of oxygen in a way that made people think that, in fact, cannabis would create certain brain changes that, in fact, I'm afraid, basically resulted from these four monkeys not getting enough air in between hits.
What were some of the other reasons the FDA gave us as to why cannabis has to stay in Schedule 1?
Well, so some of those same studies showed how poorly we measure motivation, basically. And so you do see some monkeys who aren't necessarily willing to work for a piece of lettuce after they've gotten stoned. But in all honesty, who's willing to work for a piece of lettuce? And then the standard hyping on the idea of dependence and no medical use. So the medical utility data weren't that great at the time some of those first reviews were done, but we know a whole lot better now. And then, unfortunately, the whole misunderstanding of what dependence really is and the notion of cannabis-induced problems being poorly measured and often confused for just plain old adolescents made folks think that that was reason enough to keep Schedule 1 going.
Are these kind of criteria and evaluating standards used by the FDA for other drugs, or is it only marijuana that we get monkeys stoned on?
Well, so what's sad is intranasal cocaine, which does have one medical use in ocular surgery, suddenly it gets Schedule 2. It gets the pass, and it's simply because of that one medicinal use, when in fact we do have alternative medications that do that same job, including lidocaine and some other local anesthetics. So that certainly makes no sense. And then basically drugs with no dependence potential at all, even lower than cannabis, like LSD, end up in Schedule 1. And I think it's just we don't want people thinking thoughts that aren't linear.
Very well put. As far as our endocannabinoid system, there's been a great development that I was reading about of these researchers that were able to kind of freeze a marijuana receptor, a cannabinoid receptor, to discover more about how it works. What did you pick up from this, Dr. Mitch?
I mean, the bottom line is it looks like the cannabinoid system is not as simple as we once thought. It doesn't fire up against the dopaminergic system or some of the other ones that are stereotypically associated with dependence-inducing drugs. And this notion of sort of freezing and then unfreezing creates kind of a reversible lesion, if you will, the kind of thing where you can see what the impact is and then see if it comes back. And we're finding that, you know, the cannabinoid system is important for the things that we thought, like pain modulation, inflammation in response to pain, and basically all the things that we knew were there. And this is just another way of sort of proving that with a much more straightforward approach than either blocking it chemically or actually breeding mice that don't have the CB1 receptor itself.
Very interesting stuff. And folks, if you want to look at that article, send me an email. I'll send you the link to it. I'm radicalrus@gmail.com. Now let's turn to archaeology. You and I have talked a bit in the past about the history of cannabis, how it goes all the way back to the Chinese emperors in 2700 BC and so forth. There's a new article out on a 2,500-year-old burial that hints at some ancient cannabis use. And does this expose for us the more of the recreational or health uses of cannabis versus some of the other archaeological finds?
This is kind of strange. So it's essentially using the plants to wrap the body on some of these buried participants. And I think it either was, some kind of end of life sort of care, much like we have giving people access to medications at the end of life to sort of ease their pain. Or perhaps some spiritual association between the plant, perhaps its subjective effects, and then trying to, sort of create a nice afterlife for these people. So I find it intriguing as hell because it really is plant material, not just hemp or fiber or some cloth that was made from the plant. And so I'm eager to see what the other archaeologists chime in and decide.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And we found other, Iceman, for example, buried that have, hemp cloth or hemp, materials. But this, the medical use and the recreational use is something that we're trying to discern from some of these finds. It's very interesting stuff. The next topic we've got is we got a couple of these where now that marijuana legalization is happening and it seems, inevitable, some of our opponents are turning now to ways that they can restrict it. They know they can't stop it, but how can they slow it down? One of these things is about potency. They want to set up potency limits. And that brings us to the question about whether or not cannabis actually causes some sort of drug dependence, some sort of addiction, and does high potency marijuana make any difference in the progression of this dependence? Let's get your thoughts on that, Dr. Mitch.
We've had Zachney's data since the early 90s suggesting it went. Folks are smoking high-potency cannabis. They take smaller hits, hold them less long, and end up with, peak THC levels that aren't a whole lot different from folks smoking relatively low-potency cannabis. The dependence issue has always been tried at this epidemiological level, and a lot of alarmist stuff has come out. But in truth, it doesn't seem to be the issue because we monitor dose. How high is high tends to be pretty much the same across Craig Reinemann's data for decades and decades. I do feel like the attempt to control potency is a false sense of security. So if we don't have hash oil or shatter or things like that, aren't people just going to smoke more of something else and sort of end up in the same subjective state anyway?
Yeah, it's definitely stuff that's of concern to us. And it seems to me that there's some, I think our opponents try to conflate the fear that we have of truly difficult physiologically addictive substances like heroin or OxyContin or cocaine with the mild dependence that we might get from cannabis, which is really more akin to like caffeine or tobacco. Is that fair to say?
In fact, tobacco is markedly worse, and Bob Orr and I had a chapter in Pot Politics that I wanted to call marijuana almost as addictive as caffeine. When you get professional input on this, they tend to rate caffeine just a little higher than THC. So, and also, CBD content really contributes to the subjective experience. So somebody could have a 17% strain with no CBD in it and end up feeling much more spacey and sort of intoxicating than one with 24% THC, but lots of CBD in it. So I'm afraid this is a real red herring.
So these opponents that are trying to push the idea that the higher the potency of the cannabis, the more problems people will develop with it, there's just nothing to that. I mean, it sounds to me like saying someone's more likely to be an alcoholic on gin than beer.
I like that parallel a lot when, in fact, I think you and I can both make some beer-drinking alcoholic without spreading too far outside our own families.
Yeah, right to dad, I'll tell you. Exactly. We have a question from our chat room. John Thomas out there has picked up on a study, and this is one I was going to ask you about as well. It's been printed in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry about the correlation of dependence with drug interaction. Like, if you're a drinker, are you more likely to become dependent on pot? If you're a coke user, are we being more dependent on cigarettes and so forth? What is the take home from this study? Is it something we should concern ourselves about?
I think it's worth taking note of, and my student Sarah Smucker and I did some work comparable to this earlier on. The thing is that alcohol tends to slow the metabolism of some other drugs or change it into novel substances. So cocaine by itself is particularly dependence-producing, but in combination with alcohol, it creates cocaethylene, which seems to be even more dependence-producing. Alcohol doesn't make THC more dependence-producing, but it does slow THC metabolism. Not that I'm trying to save anybody money on a cannabis bill, but simultaneous use of these does have the potential to at least make THC's impact last longer. And so that's something to keep in mind if you are basically a simultaneous polydrug user.
All right. Good information. And we'll follow up on that and perhaps write an article on that. Another question from our chat room. A listener in Hawaii wants to know about gabapentin. Basically, what is it, and is it highly addictive?
So gabapentin is fucking poison, man. I just am totally frightened of it. It's supposed to have certain analgesic effects and perhaps help folks with peripheral neuropathy. I know a subset of folks who take small doses and claim it's particularly helpful, but the negative side effects are just utterly horrifying in the small subset of folks who have them. The problem is it's impossible to predict who's going to get them and who doesn't. I'm afraid the VAs are handing them out like candy. I just begged my dad to throw a bunch of them away. I have a friend from high school who is really suffering right now after she was put on it in an effort to change some of her medical symptoms. I really think it's just not a good way to go. And if you have medical cannabis to treat neuropathy, it's far and away much safer.
The listener's asking some follow-up questions on what those side effects are, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So I want to encourage folks, if you want to learn more about this, send Dr. Mitch an email. You can reach him at 420research@gmail.com. And of course, you can catch Dr. Mitch's podcast here on cannabisradio.com, Burning Issues. And who are you speaking to on the latest podcast, Doctor?
Oh, it's two of our friends, Chris and Mickey. And
they're
going to talk about why Prop 64 is definitely a big thumbs up.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Mitch Earlywine. We appreciate all your help, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks so much, Russ.
All right. Stay tuned, folks. We got time for a radical rant coming up next on how the opponents of marijuana legalization are being joined by medical marijuana profiteers. Shocked I am. Do you hear? Shocked.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.